governance. I approach this topic both as a former member of the Reagan and Bush administrations and as a Northwestern law professor who teaches constitutional law. My experience, my academic writing, and my teaching all have been focused on the presidency and on the role of the federal courts. And I therefore want to discuss today three lessons we might learn from the Reagan-Bush years about conservative governance in the White House, and three that we might learn from those years about the federal courts. A first lesson of the Reagan-Bush presidencies, I think, is the tremendous importance of the first 2 years of any administration that's in the White House. The modern presidency, for better or worse, is something of a lightning rod. Presidents have little constitutional power in peacetime, and they can advance a domestic agenda only with support in Congress. For decades now, presidents like Reagan have had the most support in Congress in the first 2 years of their term, and have watched it dwindle with every election after the first. While Reagan did not lose the 1982 midterm elections as badly as Clinton lost the 1994 midterm elections, he did accomplish much less in the last 6 years of his term. Since 1934, every first midterm election has turned out the president's opponents in higher numbers relative to his supporters than had occurred 2 years before. This is not only relevant to a president's support in the House and the Senate, but also to his support in state houses across the country. Well over 30 states, including all the major ones, elect their governors and state legislators during the off-year midterm cycle. It's no accident that Republicans picked up a majority of governorships in 1994 for the first time since the 1960s, precisely as Democrats had controlled a majority of governorships during the Reagan, Bush, and Nixon Ford years. All of this means, I think, two somewhat contradictory things. First, it's important to make the first 2 years of any conservative administration really count. In fact, there's not a moment to spare. Nor is there any time to develop an agenda if you were not elected with one. Successful presidents must have a successful first 8 months, and there's just simply no time to lose at the start of an administration. At the same time, one also doesn't want to scare the public unnecessarily or make a presidency even more of a lightning rod than the office naturally seems to have become. President Clinton obviously made this mistake in many ways in his first 2 years in office. President Reagan, of course, came in with a clear agenda. He executed it against formidable odds, and then he was able to stay the course for the next 6 years as his opponents tried at every turn to undo what he had largely already set in motion. We need to make sure that the next conservative president who is elected makes the same good use of his first 2 years in office. A second aspect of the modern presidency, which I think challenges us as conservatives, is the press's and the public's desire for constant action and entertainment. Journalists make their living by selling newspapers, articles, magazines, and TV shows. They have an insatiable appetite for news, gossip, and entertainment, both because of their need to satisfy the public and because of their competition with one another. The emergence of the intensely competitive 24-hour news cycle and of many new media has made this phenomenon worse than ever. We seem, unfortunately, slated to go from news frenzy to news frenzy, from O.J. to Princess Diana, to Monica, to JonBenet, to Ellen. This sad aspect of modern life poses special challenges for a conservative president. Conservatives, by temperament, dislike flurries of proposals, action for its own sake, and government action in particular. And yet, the public today has very little tolerance for inaction. A key problem faced by George Bush Sr. and by Gerald Ford before him was the feeling that they were not doing anything. While I personally preferred Bush-Ford inaction to what happened when Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton started doing something, for much of the public there was and still is a great yearning to see a steady flow of proposals, speeches, programs, etc., out of the White House. A conservative president who sits back, even briefly as Bush and Ford did, gets defined by the opposition and is forced to play defense. The president has to play offense and to lead, and the public rightly expects that much. Reagan succeeded because he led with a vision of where the country and the world ought to go, and he always spoke and worked toward those ends of limited government. A third and final lesson from the Reagan-Bush years for the executive branch is the critical importance of defending and using the institutional powers of the presidency. The president has substantial ability on his own to make at least some important policy changes. through executive orders, regulations, and rulemakings, and signing statements at the time a bill becomes law, the President can importantly affect many areas of public policy. Ronald Reagan's executive orders on OMB oversight of the regulatory agencies, and on federalism, and on takings of private property, and on abortion counseling were all important uses of this power. This is made clear by President Clinton's repeal or rewriting of each of these Reagan initiatives, in one case during his first 24 hours as president. Of similar importance was President Reagan's initiative on signing statements, which Reagan launched and which President Bush continued. Under this initiative, detailed presidential history was added for the first time into the record every time Reagan or Bush signed a bill. A conservative president-elect will need immediately to assign staffers to figure out what can be done and should be done by the president unilaterally on his first day or days in office. This is an important opportunity to seize the honeymoon window and make the most of it, and to lay out an agenda for others to follow. I want now to turn from the presidency, which is my main area of expertise as a law professor, to the federal courts. And here again, let me discuss a few lessons from the Reagan-Bush era. A first lesson is the importance of nominating justices and judges who are firmly committed to the enforcement of the Constitution and to judicial restraint. Both Presidents Reagan and Bush made an unprecedented effort to find prospective justices and judges who were originalists, who would follow the text of the Constitution and laws, who understood that court decisions were not to be a function of results or consequences, but that they were to be faithful to the law. Judges who understood, as Bush once said, that they should not be running around all over the front pages of the newspaper. Reagan and Bush did much better on this score than had the three preceding Republican presidents, Ford, Nixon, and Eisenhower. In the wake of the Warren and Burger court fiascos, heroic efforts to appoint judges who believed in the separation of powers were rewarded. Nonetheless, while the final results were better than those achieved by Nixon, Ford, and Eisenhower, some appointments were disappointing, especially David Souter and, to a lesser extent, Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy. The obvious question is, how does the next conservative administration build and improve on this record? How do we make sure that the court is filled with Rehnquists, Scalias, and Thomases who follow the Constitution, rather than with Souters and Kennedys who either make it up or waffle at critical junctures? The answer to that query is as easy to state as it is hard to accomplish. Hold on to a solid majority in the U.S. Senate. The key moment at which the Reagan-Bush drive to appoint restrained justices stalled was the Bork confirmation fight. Imagine that Robert Bork or another comparable rule of law jurist had been confirmed by a Republican Senate to Lewis Powell's seat. Imagine now that incoming President Bush still had a Republican Senate and had not been bruised by the John Tower nomination defeat at the very outset of his presidency. At that point, Bush and his top aides would have been much less likely to throw the disastrous Hail Mary pass that was the David Souter nomination, and much more likely to appoint any of a number of able conservative jurists on the U.S. Courts of Appeals. Conservatives have to remember that even a popular president of the United States can do only so much without support in Congress, and in this case, in the Senate. From 1986 to 92, Reagan and Bush did not have that senatorial support, and they faced well-funded opposition from groups financed by Hollywood and by big labor. The left was and remains highly dependent on the Supreme Court to protect its agenda of legal abortion, legal pornography, and of keeping religion out of public life. Left-wing groups will again fight viciously against pro-rule of law judicial nominees. And if there's a Democratic majority in the Senate, it will be very hard to win unless there are an extraordinary number of vacancies and appointments. The first thing the Reagan-Bush experience suggests out of this is that a conservative president must at all costs keep nominating one good justice or judge after another, if need be. If the left has a majority in the Senate, or if the Senate is closely divided, or if nominees are smeared, we will have to expect to take losses. The only solution is to keep coming back with more good nominees. As Reagan was once forced to grimly say, the Senate cannot defeat them all. And that is true. In fact, many senators hate judicial confirmation fights, and they may tend, having voted against a president on one nomination, to be with him on the next, even if the two nominees are not all that different. The first key to success with judges, then, is for the president and his staff to have a long and good list of choices. A second key lesson is the importance of fighting hard for a good nominee like Robert Bork. Confirmation fights like the Bork or Thomas fights are nothing less than mini presidential campaigns with national fundraising, polling, and mobilization. Finding a good lawyer who would make a good justice, who is also a compelling figure in such a fight, is hard. Mobilizing the president's administration and supporters on behalf of that nominee is harder still. But it's critical that a president fight and fight hard for his nominees even if he loses. Reagan and Bush, by and large, did this, and Clinton, as Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood quickly learned, does not. It's critical to a president's success that he fight hard for his judicial nominees. Another lesson from the Reagan-Bush era that bears on the federal courts is the tremendous importance of the lower federal courts, both district courts and federal circuit courts of appeals. The U.S. Supreme Court today decides only 80 of the several hundred thousand cases a year that are filed in the federal courts. This means that as a practical matter, for the overwhelming majority of litigants and of cases, more than 99%, a district or circuit judge has the final word. Both Presidents Reagan and Bush made a determined effort to find lower court judicial nominees who were as qualified as Supreme Court justices. Such an effort for the lower federal courts requires a large staff based in the Department of Justice, not the White House, if it is to be done thoroughly. Everything written or published by a nominee needs to be read carefully by several individuals with a great deal of training themselves to help identify the best candidates. Reading a prospective nominee's prior opinions, articles, briefs, or other writings is the best way to learn whether they have an understanding of what distinguishes the role of a judge. Had David Souter's New Hampshire Supreme Court opinions been read more carefully by more people, under less time pressure, the indicia of his activism and lack of understanding of the proper judicial role would have been seen. A final point of critical importance is the quality of the litigation effort presented by the Department of Justice in the U.S. Supreme Court and in the lower federal courts on key constitutional issues. This effort, in turn, depends greatly on the ability and jurisprudential philosophy of the Solicitor General, of the key Assistant Attorneys General, and of the Attorney General himself. The Reagan and Bush litigation efforts were continuously set back by recalcitrant career lawyers in the Solicitor General's office and by the personalities of the men who served as Solicitor General. The briefs and administration files in the Supreme Court or in the lower courts on major constitutional issues are critically important. They provide much of the raw material and sometimes all too much of the reasoning that goes into the final opinions themselves. Those briefs must be first-rate and jurisprudentially sound. A conservative administration cannot rely on pro-rule of law judges to save the country from the administration's own lawyers. Good constitutional decisions or opinions, or if need be, dissents, are aided by hiring terrific lawyers who file terrific briefs. 12 or 20 years ago, it was hard to find enough good originalist lawyers to write such briefs. Today, it should be no problem at all. In closing, I've tried to suggest a number of things the next conservative president might do bearing on the executive and judicial branches, growing out of the experiences of past administrations and relying upon what I've learned from studying, writing about, and teaching constitutional law. The task ahead will be challenging, but it's been made much easier, as have so many things, by Ronald Reagan, who showed us all how governance from the White House could be done right. Thank you.